Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rutt, and we definitely can talk about Christmas now.
Meri kirihi meti, Bookends listeners.
Yes, and we hope that you're getting those stacks of books ready to hand out to all your loved ones, all the whānau.
Exactly. Enjoy all that wrapping and ribbon and beautiful books.
No, but it's all got to be recyclable.
Okay, of course.
Yes, we're not encouraging waste here in, on Bookends.
The drawer of ribbons from the many past years, Christmases past, has been pulled out and they're all being reused.
Yep, that's what's happening in my house. And I'm happy to say that the short-lived AI controversy is over about whether the covers of two of the books the authors I'm talking to today, the fact that AI has been used in their covers was going to prevent them being able to be in contention for next year's book awards. That is over for now. The books are back in, and it's something that is going to be considered.
Well, I'm glad too that it's over, because I don't think that the authors and their writing deserve to be barred on the basis of those decisions. So I'm delighted for them, because you've got one of those, right? You've
interviewed both of them
today. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. And both using the same publisher, Quentin Wilson, who's an old friend of this show, being an Otatahi, a publisher of long standing. So, yes, I'm talking to both Stephanie Johnson and Elizabeth Smither today, and I was going to have a long discussion with them about AI, but fortunately that didn't need to happen.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. And both beautiful books and lovely interviews. I got to do interview Niels Meyer Westfield, and he has written a book called Feathers of Aotearoa, and it's full of exquisite drawings of feathers and Aotearoa birds. So it's a delightful interview, and this is one that definitely, for any budding nature artist whom you want to encourage, it'd be one to include, or any lover of birds. That's just a gorgeous book.
Angel Train is the latest book from Elizabeth Smither. It is four novellas, and Elizabeth has become renowned for not just her work as a poet, but her stories and novels as well. She's won numerous awards, including the New Zealand Book Award for Poetry and the Montana New Zealand Book Award for Poetry, and she was the New Zealand Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. She's also been acknowledged by the Prime Minister for her literary achievement in poetry in 2008, and she is going to have another collection of poetry published next year. But today we're going to be talking about novellas, and I think we have to start, Elizabeth, on what is a novella and what is the what's the intrigue for you in writing in this form?
I'm not really sure, Maureen. I remember once when I was in London, I met Gavin Newitt, and we were having lunch with some other writers, and I think he wrote a review later, and he wondered if the short story was really my thing. And sometimes I've thought of that, but the definition of the novella is quite hard to come by, really. It can be. I thought I would write four of them and do about 20,000 words on each, But what happened, even though I wrote those links for each of them, with cutting and editing, some are wee bit shorter than others. So I don't think there's a rigid formula, but you know when you're writing it, you're not writing a novel. You're not going into that big meandering mess that is a novel, which is always seems to me to be rather like music, like a symphony or something, and you need patches of quietness and repose in it, as well as excitement and action. But the novella doesn't seem to make those sort of stringent demands on you, and if you can get hold of a story, you can just sort of let rip with the story and meander about in that, and you know the end is coming, you know, sooner rather than later.
And you don't have to compress it in the way you would a short story.
No, it's not quite so compressed as a short story, and it's probably wider in its concept. A short story might be about a single incident or something, but the novella can have more characters in it. It can have more things happening, a range of things happening probably. It's much more ambiguous, but again, as I said before, you've got the feeling that the end is sort of in sight, so it won't go on for too long.
They're extremely satisfying to read, I think, because of that, because you can indulge yourself in storytelling in them, can't you?
That's right. You've got more space. You can every word, you do want to compress as much as you can, but you can sort of indulge yourself, I think it is, really, when you're writing a novella. And my way of writing is that I never know where I'm going. So it's quite fun writing them, really. I never have a plot in mind. I just have a basic idea, and then the characters that sort of develop out of it.
That's interesting because, yeah, I don't... Well, I think with the first one in particular, and maybe the last one, and we'll just touch on them later, but maybe I get the sense that, yes, you started with something and you weren't sure how it was going to... play out?
That's right. Well, the first one, the one about the writing tour I did in the UK, with a very fine and lovely poet called Julia Darling, really is sort of like a recollection of that in a way. Julia was dying. She had breast cancer, but I didn't realise that for a while because the publishers didn't actually tell me, and I felt quite jealous that whenever we stayed at an inn or a little hotel, Julia always had a room with a bath, and I thought, why do I have to have a shower? But of course, she needed a bath to rest her body and, you know, get warm and so forth. And she had two wigs with her, and, you know, some nights she'd wear one and some nights she'd wear the other. One looked like Lauren Bacall and the other one looked like Audrey Hepburn. And she, you know, she'd lie on her bed, getting herself ready to go out, and we'd read together. And we became very fond of one another. And also, Julia was a great contributor to things in poetry. She wrote books that were left in hospitals in Britain. She did readings all over the place. She was a really wonderful person just to be with, and I loved being in her company. And it was sort of tragic in a way, but Julia gave no impression that she was ill whatsoever. It was only later when we retired to the pub or something that I could see how really tired she was.
Yes, and fragile. It is a lovely, as you say, it's a lovely relationship that develops because, as you say, in the beginning, the New Zealand poet is and the end, because, you know, the English poet is so... so fragile, yes, so affected. They are slightly standoffish at the beginning.
That's right, and there's sort of an English reserve.
Yes,
I think Northerners are not so reserved, really. But you know, you know, usually writers introduce themselves to one another quite slowly. What I remember terribly much about it was that one night when we read it at a workhouse, and Julia was terribly affected by the atmosphere of it, just sort of, though it was covered in thick white paint and, you know, had stairs going up, one set of stairs for men and boys and the other for women and girls. She just said it gave her the creeps.
She could see
horrible.
The spectres, couldn't she?
Yes.
Well, in your story, she can.
Yes, well, that's right. And there were sort of books in which they mentioned things, and I think one was about a talented young musician who was very poor and had tried very hard to get work at country houses and places like that. But it was so hard. And I think he was sleeping in a hedge or something. And finally he must have succumbed and come into the workhouse, which, you know, would have been filled with well-meaning people, but they would be forced to listen to lectures and things like that. And mm-hmm. it would be horrible for him.
So you wrote that after she died. I mean, clearly we do know mm. how that story ends because... she's going to die, but...
She was planning her funeral. We talked a lot about that. She'd found a funeral director who had a horse, you know, and the black plumes and everything, you know, the muffled hooves, and she was working on that. She'd really designed what she wanted to do, and so we talked about it quite a lot.
It is the most affecting story, and I think it's been interesting to see how the critics... that, you know, since this collection's come out, how they've identified that as being one of the stories that's most, you know, that has resonated most with them.
Mm.
And I think it's that sense of love that grows between the poets and the fact that they are so far apart at the end, but they're so linked.
Yes, that's exactly right. And when I didn't know that I was notified that she died, to my surprise, I let out an enormous scream.
Uh-huh.
I'm not given to screaming at all, but just the way it affected me, I suppose.
The second one about the highwayman, which is set in Tasmania, you use that wonderful poem that I hadn't thought of for years, but as soon as I started reading it, I realised that I must have had it read to me as a child or at school, the one about the highwayman.
That's right. I think a lot of children that age read it, and they often read it together, sort of chanting it, you know, with the highwayman and his horse and everything. Yes, it is a lovely poem, and I don't know whether school children read poems aloud like that now, but we often did at school.
I suspect they don't, but yes, we did. And you're quite right, the rhythm of it sticks in your brain, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly does. The horse—he's on the horse, of course. And actually, Maureen, there is actually a highwayman in my family.
Oh, is there? So
yes,
this is—is
yes.
is this the
sort
Tasmanian
on
one, or?
Yes, sort of based on him. Yes, but he wasn't a vicious highwayman at all. He was sort of—he would, if he thought a person, you know, should keep their things, he'd let them keep them. And I think he redistributed what he took off people, you know. Sometimes there would be a coach probably carrying money, you know, to Hobart or something, perhaps government money or something. But I think that he was very courteous to women and so forth, and if they try to get their rigs off, he'd just say leave it or something. So he didn't actually get arrested or anything. I think he might have got arrested or something, but he wasn't a dangerous sort of highwayman.
Well, it's lovely the way you link with, because one of my favourite people in these stories is Maud, the owner of the shop who's been widowed. And
yes,
is
that's one of my aunts.
Yes. Oh, yes. My goodness. She's a thoroughly well-drawn character, and I can see her in the old shop. And I can really empathise with her and how she tries to carry on after her husband dies.
That's right, because people died of peritonitis, you know, with appendicitis, didn't they, in those days? Unless they got help in time. And, of course, rural doctors could be miles away, you know, so it could happen like that. Hmm.
Yeah, it's a lovely story of a friendship between two women that doesn't involve sexuality. It's just a gentle coming together of two lonely women. And how they support each other. And then there's the story of the highwayman underneath it.
That's right.
So you're looking there, I think, at whether there are whether DNA sort of continues and makes Maud the more, generous person she is.
She had she was very kind to people who were in hard circumstances. She would let them have credit, and she was always giving them extra buns on things. But she was quite fierce on people who had a lot of money, and she felt they should pay up straight away. Yes. So that's how she ran the shop, really. But, she was very kind to people who were having a hard time.
Should we be looking for links in these stories, or are these just stories that you think of as being standalone?
Yes, I don't think of them as morals or anything. I just think it's curious. I do think that things, genetic things, can be carried right down through a line. I mean, you might have a person who's very mingy with money or something, and that can run on the family, that people are very, very managerial or something, or the opposite. There are family traits, I think, but they can go back a very long way, and they skip generations, and all sorts of things happen. But I'm not trying to make a moral point of it. It's just a sort of a supposition, I suppose.
That's a good one. The last one, the middle one, I would talk forever about each one of these. The last one is curious because it's set, it's the one that's really set solely in New Zealand.
Yes,
In the
National Park.
Yes. Which of course is blackened at the moment. But there's there's three people whose relationship you don't go into. I mean, obviously there's a couple and a friend.
Yes.
But we don't know anything really about these people other than the fact that the couple have a holiday place, their friend mm-hmm. comes with them. And then they're observing and being curious about one of these sort of ohakuni-type places.
Yes. Well, I found it a very interesting place, and I went there quite a lot. We went up quite a few times, and it's a place with, again, it's got strata, the people that live there all year and the people that come in, the tourists, the people who have sort of holiday places there, some of them very posh and they're always locked up and so forth. And then there's the curiosity of the landscape because when the snow has gone, where the chalet is up above the snow line, it suddenly becomes bare and rather frightening. And then when the snow comes, there's a totally different landscape. And, of course, the tourists arriving all the time, you see them tramping up the roads, going to stay in hostels or hotels. And it's one of those curious places that sort of runs on tourism. And I was really interested in the train that came through. We used to go to the railway station, which was turned into a rather delightful cafe, and the train used to stop there for about half an hour, and tourists would get out and have meals and things. And we used to sit on one of the benches and drink brandy out of brandy balloons, and sort of, tourists would get off and they'd probably think, are these typical natives of this place?
Yes.
So we had quite a bit of fun, and the train, sometimes other trains would go through and there'd be rattling noises as the cafe would shake. And then there was this train that went through sometime around midnight when the place was quiet and you get this whistling of the train and the smoke and the whole feeling of the train wailing across the landscape. It was a fascinating landscape, really fascinated me.
It's like
a lot of places that have lots of tourist input, you wonder what the heart of the place is.
Mm. I was intrigued by that too because I was taken to the chateau by my parents, my brother and I, for a weekend when I was about five, and I have never forgotten it. It was, and I've obviously embroidered it and made it into a far grander place than it probably was, but the chateau is very much part of the story too.
Oh, yes, it's a wonderful hotel. And if you want to really treat yourself there with the chateau was operating, you'd go there and have an elaborate afternoon tea or something and loll around and watch the rabbits playing on the lawn.
Yes.
And it was really, really, it was a wonderful hotel. I hope they save it. It's a magnificent hotel.
So and do I.
Yeah, just a wonderful place. And in its heyday, it must have been really something, the people descending the stairs for dinner, dressed up and, having a lovely time.
Well, those were the days when people did dress up for
dinner. Yes, indeed they did. Yes.
So this story is all about your imaginings, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes, it is. It's also, you make up stories, you know. It's part of being a writer, isn't it, making up things.
It is, and we are the wonderful beneficiaries of that. Elizabeth, I won't go into all the AI sort of controversy that has swirled about this book, but all I'll say is thank goodness it's been resolved and it's going to be in contention for the awards next year.
Yes, thank you. I'm really pleased it's been resolved too. I think it'll be, eventually there'll be some regulations made that will be carefully considered and so forth. But I think AI is really everywhere, isn't it? You know, it's in medicine, it's in industries. We have to, you know, really think about it, you know. We're all using these things all the time.
And I'm sure people will be writing a lot of stories about it. So thank you for bringing us these four novellas. Wonderful reading and, as usual, perfect and poetic prose.
Thank you, Maureen.
The book is called Angel Train. It's by Elizabeth Smither and it's published by Quentin Wilson Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Stephanie Johnson is one of our best-known and loved writers of fiction and poetry. In 2019, she was appointed a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to literature. She's also the recipient of the prestigious Prime Minister's Literary Award for Fiction and was recently made a Fellow of the Academy of New Zealand Literature. This new collection of short stories, Obligate Carnivore, is Stephanie at her sparkling best. Stephanie, you, when you started with your writing, the first book I think that was published was actually poetry.
Yes, it was. The Bleeding Ballerina, it was called.
Yes, great title.
Yeah, I don't write so much poetry now. It's funny, I don't know whether that happens to a lot of writers, but yeah, at that stage, I was writing plays. That's really how I started out, as a playwright. And then And poetry, yeah. But then sort of in my early 20s, I went to live in Australia and I was, removed from that kind of milieu that I'd been in and sort of surrounded by actors and things. And that was when I started to write prose or to write more prose.
Yeah. But was it short stories that you went to, or did you?
Yes, I had a collection of short stories published by the New Women's Press here and by Picador in Australia, Glass Whittler. And then not long after that, my first novel, Crimes of Neglect.
So where do you fit in short story writing? Is it around the novel writing, or do you have...
Yes, I just sort of write them as they occur to me. And so this is my fourth collection of short stories, and some of them were written as long ago as 20 years ago. You know, so I've been living with these stories for a very long time. Not all of them. Some of them were written much more recently. But, I've never sort of sat down to write a collection of short stories.
It's gathering them up at a certain stage. I wonder what it's like for you to go back when you decide to put a collection like this out. Going back, what do you notice about your interests, your craft, your, what had piqued... what had inspired them?
Often stories people have told, little anecdotes people have told me, or sometimes media stories. I wrote a story in the last few days, actually, a new story about, which was it based on a news story of this. It's a very sad story, actually, about a woman who was found dead in her car outside what had been the family home that she'd grown up in. And I think this was a news story about 4 or 5 years ago, but it sort of obviously hooked itself into my mind, and I wrote a story. In the last few days, I've been working on a story about exactly that. So, I have, like most writers, I have a notebook, and I always keep a notebook, and I will write down ideas for short stories as they occur to me. And then sometimes I'll come across that idea and it'll be all rearing and ready to go. I want to write it.
I read somewhere that, I don't know whether this is, you do all of them quickly, but that you can write a short story quite quickly.
Yeah, I'm in my 60s now, in my early 60s, so I have slowed down. I think that's also quite a common experience for writers as they get older. So I don't write them as fast as I used to. I mean, possibly because I'm harder on myself, and also I like to sort of write a draft or two and then let them sit.
Mm. Yes, I was wondering whether you wrote them quickly but then went back. And
oh yes, I mean that was with Obligate Carnival, some of those stories I've been living with for a very long time,
and working on them till you got
not a lot, but when I was putting the collection together, there were stories that I jettisoned that aren't in the collection, and other stories that I thought, that's a good story. I wouldn't have read it for a decade.
But it still rings true. Well, there's no sense that any of them are out of date.
That's encouraging.
Well, knowing that they do span those decades, I can accept the fact that, the later ones have a lot more digital stuff in them, and others don't, but that doesn't
well,
date them.
Human nature doesn't fundamentally change, does it?
So, not at all. And the things that pique your interest, and you find a story in them, that's pretty timeless too, isn't it? So it's peccadilloes, you're not always trying to skewer people. There's a lot of humanity in these stories. Has any of that changed? Do you think you've become more more mellow, or the things?
Oh, probably. I mean, there's that old adage, isn't there? The older you get, the less you know. I mean,
yep.
I think the less you're less certain of things, and I think, the world we live in at the moment is so grim and confusing on so many levels that I do like to make readers laugh, So, the title story, Obligate Carnivore, about the cat, it is really a story about the environment, I suppose, but it's couched in a more humorous, ironic kind of tone.
Of course. Calling the cat Gareth Morgan is immediately would have people chuckling. And then the fact that the cat does get his or her or their revenge.
He's a boy cat.
Yeah, yes,
He gets his revenge. Yes, he does.
Yeah.
And I mean that story. A few of the stories in the book are autobiographical, and that to an extent. And that story, came about from, I've always had dogs. I'm a great dog lover, but I'm disabled, and of course it's getting worse as I get older. And so the dog before last was a blue heeler, and who I just adored. The Australian kettle dog.
Yes.
That needed a lot of exercise and a lot of stimulation. Anyway, she lived a big, long life. She died when she was 16. And I said to my husband, I'd like to get a little cat. Anyway, he was exactly like the husband in the story, and just went on and on and on about how we shouldn't have cats in New Zealand and it's appalling and blah, 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 blah. So
yeah,
in the end, I went and got myself a staffy.
Oh, did you? I was...
So I never got a little cat.
You never did? Well, that's in the future. Sneak a cat into that. And, of course, you know, the woman in the story ruins the cat's teeth by giving it a vegetarian diet, which, of course, cats...
Yeah, no, well, he has his teeth... they have the teeth removed.
Oh, that's right. But doesn't she feed it...
Oh, yeah, she tries to feed it vegetarian food or vegan food. And, you know, and this is the cats are obligate carnivores. They have to have meat in order to maintain any kind of health. And you do read occasionally or hear of people who have cats and dogs that they're not feeding meat to, and which is cruel, really.
Yes, well, goes against nature. And often these people are very green in inclination. One of the other stories that I found really touching was the one about the boy who comes, you know, from very rich and pretty uninvolved parents. He's sent to New Zealand from Singapore and turns up in his father's apartment, and he's only about 15 or 16. I can't remember if you've given him an age. And he goes out and I won't say he bonds necessarily with a street boy of around about his own age, but it's a really unsettling story, that one.
Well, I was thinking about middle class neglect, you know, and there is a fair bit of it around, you know. You'll talk to teachers, you know, who are dealing with children arriving at school at the age of five, still wearing a nappy, and not able to speak in complete sentences, and this is because their parents are just, you know, these children they're not from poor families by any means, and the parents just aren't giving the child the attention that a little human needs, you know, in order to meet its milestones. And you know, and I, over the years, you know, I had my children are all grown up. I've got grandchildren now. But, you know, so I do periodically hear these stories about children who have been, you know, stuck in the daycare, as tiny little babies, and not met their milestones, but not for any reason other than the parents are just not that interested in them.
Yeah, there's another story too where a mother has left, become a loose cannon, you call her, left her family and with her husband. But then she discovers her husband has abandoned the children as well.
Yes, well, they're older kids, of course. I mean, they're teenagers, you know. And that was a sort of a story I'd heard about a woman who had done exactly that. And that you know, there's this phenomenon, I'm sure you've heard of it, although the woman in that story is a bit younger, but the silver splitters. And
yes.
In my story, Library Mourning for Lost Men, you know, that...
Yeah.
I touch on that again, you know, where, you know, that it is a social phenomenon. There is a huge increase in divorce in people, you know, in their senior years.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's understandable on one level that the wives are just, you know, they've had enough, you know. They've been looking after families and the children have grown and gone and the husband still expects the same sort of level of service.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, so, but once again, you know, trying to couch these things in a sort of, in a humorous way, even though they're serious subjects.
Yeah, well, the one that was recently in Reading Room about the man who goes for counselling and... Mm. You know, that's a case of people splitting at a later stage. But the thoughts that he runs through as he's on the couch or sitting with the counsellor. You know, it is very bittersweet, isn't it, the situation that those people find themselves in.
Yes, yes. I mean, look, all of us who have, who are married, you know, marriage can be very difficult.
Yeah.
You know? And society doesn't exactly so much reward you for that now, you know, for sticking it out, you know. I can recommend it. I think it's good to be, you know, to have your soulmate and your companion that you've been with for many years.
Mm. Mm. Yep. Well, I'm a fan of that. Although, aren't short stories good for capturing these things?
Yes. Well, you can. You know, it's a short story. You can really distill it down, you know, to that absolute essence. Whereas with a novel, especially a big sort of sprawling novel, you can look at all sorts of different ideas. You know, whereas a short story really can only carry, you know, one or two major ideas.
Are you still teaching creative writing?
No, not really. In my generation of writers, there were no writing schools.
No,
of
course not.
And also, I mean, I was born and raised in Auckland, but I ran off down to Christchurch, and I did my undergraduate degree at Canterbury. And so that was 1979, 80, 81, and I did English Lit and History and music papers, actually, but my major is in English Literature. So, and I've always been, you know, a massive reader. So I think, and I've also always written, you know, like I was writing stories from the time I was very little. And so, you know, that was really how I sort of learned to write in inverted commas, although I do think it's a gift. You know, I do think that people are, some of us are sort of born with the ability to spin a tale, you know.
I absolutely agree. Yeah.
And so I never did a writing course in my life. And so the university, you know, I did teach at Auckland University for a while with Wiki when he was there.
Mm.
But when they discovered that I didn't have a PhD or not even an MA. That was apparently deemed to be very irregular, and so I lost my job. But I have gone on teaching sort of in a sort of guest role at different tertiary institutions around New Zealand, and I do really enjoy it. And but I'm not a theorist. You know, I'm a practitioner.
Yes, of course.
And so that seems to have very much fallen out of favour. You know, like I've heard of a woman a few years ago, who was teaching creative writing at the University of Western Sydney, and she had never even published a single damn thing. Good. You know, so I find this very peculiar. But anyway, that's just what's happened in the world.
Bizarre.
I do a lot of mentoring still, and manuscript assessments and things, and I enjoy that. I do enjoy working with writers and helping them to bring something to fruition.
Mm. Yeah, it must be very satisfying. Well, thank you, Stephanie, for putting this book out into the world.
Oh, thank you for talking to me about it, Maureen.
My pleasure. They are entertaining, they are challenging, they are subversive at times, but they're extremely well written by a human being called Stephanie Johnson and published by another human being called Quentin Wilson. Thank you, Stephanie.
Okay, thanks, Maureen.
Good luck. Yeah, bye.
Thanks.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Listeners, do you remember the magic of finding a gorgeous feather as a child? Niels Maya Westfeld does, and every lovingly crafted page of his recently published book, Feathers of Aotearoa, invites us back to that childlike state of wonder and pleasure. Niels joins me in the studio this morning, a day after being included in the Newsroom Top Illustrated Books list. Oh. Congratulations, Niels.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about my book. I really appreciate that. It's fantastic, so thank you.
You're most welcome. Bit of a thrill to be on Steve Bronius's list.
Yeah, I heard he can be harsh, but I was really fortunate to get away with a good comment. It's much appreciated. Never take this for granted.
Yeah. No, indeed, indeed. Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful illustrated book. You have a graphic design background that I imagine makes you pretty particular about the look and feel of the finished published product. You must be pretty happy with how the book's turned out.
From a graphic design point of view, yes, I am. It's a process that takes a while, you know, to consider typefaces and layout and all those things. When they're done well, they're actually not really seen as much, you know. So they just create a mood and underlying feeling, which is equally important, but less recognized than more obvious things like the actual illustrations or the things you're writing about. No? So graphic designer, yeah, that's my trade. So that's where I came from from a professional point of view. Most of my professional life, I was a graphic designer, you know, in print and then in digital media. That's why. But what I really like doing is illustrating.
Is illustrating. Well, yeah. But I think it's worth just acknowledging the graphic design elements in this publication because it's landscape, the format, the paper stock, the beautiful yeah. dust jacket. They all give it a lot of sophistication and yet a real intimacy. You know, it feels like a book that you want to touch and take yeah. time with. And as someone who I imagine has your own strong ideas about all of that, I was interested, what was it like working with Potten and Burton on that? And just if you could just talk about the process of producing the book.
So at this point, I think Robbie Burton deserves some credit because I've done a book before about 10 or 11 years ago, and we used a similar paper stock and the same format. In fact, I used the same template. I wanted to build on any recognition that you know was coming with the first book. And so he was instrumental in terms of selecting the paper and the size of the book. And so he needs some credit for that, definitely. But the problem with the format was that I had all these pictures, landscape and portrait, and to find a good format that allows, you know, each picture to be represented in a good way wasn't easy.
Yeah. Indeed, indeed.
And you, yeah.
They are, well, they are very beautifully. There's space for all of the images, and they really it's a very much an art piece, this book. Listeners, I recommend you. Feathers of Aotearoa might make listeners think that it's all feathers, illustrations of feathers. It's not. It's illustrations of birds and their feathers. And that brings me to this. You've got this deep, deep study of feather types, Niels, and yeah. of anatomy that's evident in the detail of your drawings of the birds. It's kind of like you've layered the birds up from the inside by understanding all the feathers and knowing where they sit. Then when you've drawn the birds, it's like you've layered up the birds so that they're plump and full in the image. Is that how you do it? And are you drawing them in that detail, layering them on top of each other?
So this how I was led to feathers. So I had mostly using photos as a reference, and they're not very good. So especially if you're not a professional photographer or anything like this, I often have to put up with quite mediocre photos, and then I'm trying to make things up. And it's good for the most parts, but there are always details that just missing on the, you know, and you have to either make it up, which I don't really like, or have another look and then trying to fill the gaps, you know, and feathers. Suddenly I realize, oh, a feather is such a good reference for color and also the size, you know, it gives you a good impression of the whole size of the bird. And I just always had a few in my studio and they just picked up casually and they became more and more and were really useful for most illustrations and you know, and enabled me to go into all these details that otherwise wouldn't be known or couldn't be seen on photos.
It's extraordinary, the detail about bird anatomy, feather structure, and then all the different feather types where they sit on the bird. I know it's kind of typical of nature artists, I think, to really familiarize themselves with the anatomy of the animals that they're drawing. But to a lay person, that precision seems extraordinary. Are there other nature artists that you reference who worked this way? How did you come to this kind of understanding?
Oh, I'm a bit fascinated with Ray Ching, and from photos I've seen, he's got a big collection of stuffed birds, I think, which is quite a good reference. In fact, you see the whole thing and he also, I think, like me, collects all other sort of natural artifacts, you know, like skulls and bones. Or I've got a collection of pieces of wood or things I'm not just vaguely find interesting. And one day, you know, they will be dug up for a picture. and I've got an object table where I put these things. And they often lead to ideas. So the ideas come out of the things I've got already, and then if I've got enough photos, I sort of shape something in my head, and basically everything is allowed, you know, everything that gets me there, that I get the full picture of a composition. I also go for a lot of walks where I just get ideas and often come home empty-handed, although I carry my camera. Often I not take a single photo, but it's those little moments, those little corners sometimes in a certain area that, oh, yeah, there's something about it. And then I was trying to, you know, to hook into something.
Yeah.
You know? And then there's those moments when they're not coming, it can be really frustrating. That you can have the best material and it's still not happening, and it's those little moments I'm collecting as well, if you know what I mean, in my head.
The moments that bring them all together, because yeah. these illustrations do all capture, or the bird illustrations capture a specific moment with birds. Some, you know, very beautifully. There's the pukeko striding yeah. on 71 with plump on the page, and then there's the tururu on 95 yes. fascinated and attentive and about to pounce. The moments that bring those together, they must bring you a lot of joy.
It's like music, you know, when you hear a certain song, in my case the 80s, it brings you back to a certain moment in your life. And these pictures of birds do the same thing for me. They bring me back to when I met the bird, or the day, what the day was like. And, you know, when the hall, for example, was in our place where we lived before we moved to this place where we are at the moment. And there was this poop on our track. And it was always there, and I could never really figure out where it came from until I looked up, and there was a big panga. And sure enough, the little family of moorpokes were hiding in there. Almost, you know, if you wouldn't look right at it, you wouldn't see them.
Yeah, that is the most beautiful illustration. There's so much character in those birds, and it's amazingly detailed for the palette that's available to you to use for Rūru. It's very, it's an extraordinary image. Well,
thanks, man. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So more porks than we had the wood pigeons and other birds that are literally living around my house and have gone very dear to my heart, even if I wouldn't be drawing them. You know, they deserve every credit for being beautiful and live their lives next to us, you know, humans.
Yeah, lifting us up. You mentioned the link between conservation and art. And from memory, I think you're discussing art's ability to help us relive or feel that connection. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts about that.
So while I was studying feathers, I just realized that Mother Nature doesn't do any extra curls and doesn't, you know, every single feather is very tightly tuned into a certain environment, and often unrelated birds have the same feather, you know, and that makes me realize there isn't any wiggle space, you know. They have to have this feather in order to, you know, have a certain style of flight or requirements for insulation or temperatures they need to maintain. And considering how little space there is for experiments, if you like, you suddenly realize the environment that we humans change so much. Mm. What it really means for those birds, you know, if you could put someone who lived here 200 years ago into the Vairepa on a farm paddock, he wouldn't know where he is, you know. The environment has changed so much. All the forest is gone. There are vast stretches with little to go by for birds. And they're so finely tuned into a certain niche of the environment that these changes must have been absolutely dramatic. And in fact, many are on the brink and have gone already. So we need to really look through our eyes a wee bit and realize what a, you know, the margins are really small for many of our birds.
Feathers as a way to recognise the transience, I thought was lovely theme in the book because of the fact that feathers degrade much, much quicker than other materials. So they're like, you know, so we don't know what the feathers of extinct birds look like. And I thought that was a really lovely point well made in the book, and it's a nice concept that idea that the transience of feathers should help bring us to a sense of the urgency of conservation. So thank you for that. Niels, the book is filled with specialist knowledge. But it still manages to be fun. The takahe pooping 9 metres, I've already mentioned that in another interview. The blue penguin having 3 or 4 times the feathers of a flying bird, and the new structural colour. There's so much detail in here.
Yeah.
It's a book that I think lovers of nature watercolours will enjoy, but equally one that I can imagine sharing with a child for all those little details. Was that part of your intention?
Absolutely. I think I've got 2 boys, that they're young boys, and I just see how kids looking at nature, and they're so important for the future, as I said, with birds needing our help and so on. So they are they're not judgmental. They just look with a fresh pair of eyes on all these things. There's no yucky things or nothing, you know, the touch spiders and all that. So it's really, really refreshing to see kids interacting with nature. They pick up feathers. They want to know. They you know, and to hook into that is just very exciting and get these honest questions and answers from kids sometimes as well. It's really, really, really great.
Mm.
And most kids, you know, most kids draw as well. So I've lots in common with them. I might just be one of them. You know, I never stop drawing and I never stop picking up things from the ground, you know. And many kids, sadly, in my opinion, stop doing this when they grow up and develop other interests and have opinions about things, you know. And I think kids are important for me as an artist, you know.
Well, I think your illustrations and the mad detailed facts will delight adults and children alike, and those illustrations definitely invoke a sense of childlike wonder and pleasure in the softness and the beauty of birds. So thank you so much for joining us this morning. The book is Feathers of Aotearoa by Niels Meyer Westfeld, published by Potten and Burton, and hopefully there are still copies available for prezzies for Kirihimiti from all the bookstores, from a bookstore near you. Thank you very much, Niels.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.